Summer holidays are over for us anyway, and we're back on the podcast. This week, we're looking at Egg. I take a fond look at the week I spent on the People's Republic just recently, almost a quarter of a century since the historic community buyout, and reflect on the incredible progress there's been. We look also at progress in integrating refugees. Scotland, apparently, one of the most successful countries in the world. Who knew? And who's unaware that we may have to defend that record very soon against Priti Patel's new legislation. We look as well at the lack of progress in moving towards a progressive community justice policy instead of banging folk up in jail. And of course, we ask, what are the Scottish Lib Dems actually for? Those are the headlines. Now for the podcast.
Hi chums, and welcome to this week's Leslie Riddick podcast. We're back for your holidays, and the big question I've got to ask you, Leslie, is a week enough on Egg?
Well, do you know something? I didn't even get that. What's that? Was that a slight sort of
enough?
A sort of Sellers kind of thing?
Enough is a week enough. Oh, enough is an egg in French.
Sorry.
That's all right.
Oh, God. Well, you see, that's just how much the mind sort of drifts into other domains, basically. Although, actually, to be honest with you, I have this complete sort of problem mentally with seeing cartoons. I don't get them. It's just so embarrassing. I kind of don't see relationships between things and puns. See, between you and me, there's one human being. But anyway, so fine. Yes, the earth of egg. Well, actually, egg in every language means edge and ridge. Mm-hmm. Egg means, it's in Icelandic, Norwegian, Gaelic, it means the ridge. And it's interesting because if you ever see the outline of egg, it's got this long basalt ridge. It's got two, actually, one called the skua. And that's really, it's the edge. And of course, everything was named, especially by the Norse, who were the inhabitants of those islands for a very long period, by what they saw from the sea. So, you know, they're very descriptive names, really, in many cases. Anyway, la-di-da, Egg, the People's Republic of Egg, as people will well know. I mean, that was brilliant because actually, I don't know if I've spent an entire week on Egg. It was always rushed weekends, long weekends, during the buyout period. And it's extraordinary. I mean, it's next year, it'll be 25 years since the egg buyout, a quarter of a century. It's, you know, astonishing because it just obviously time's flying in every respect. And I mean, what was really stunning going back was to see not just the old buyout crew, who are perhaps some of my oldest friends, but their children and their children. And a sort of, you know, the beginnings of just ordinary settlement where you recognise a kid who is a grandchild of, you know, the buyout lot, and they have no idea who you are, which is kind of odd in some ways. But actually, that's what the whole thing was about. Yeah. It was about them, about this being left in the past, about them just being ordinary islanders now who are never looking over their shoulders, who don't need to constantly refer back or think back to the days before. They were in charge of the whole island. And what's just astonishing when you go around the place is how much busyness there is. I mean, let me give you one example. I was also staying in a fabulous bothy that gave me time to sort of read, and I was able to put my brain into reading again, which was great. And I actually read, I was reading a couple of histories of egg, one of which was explaining just how it got to the way it was at the moment. Just beneath this long ridge, the skua, there's a kind of almost platformy bit called Grúlin, which was actually one of the most fertile areas on egg. And has the writer was describing the constant occupancy of that area from prehistoric times. I mean, it's astonishing the amount of stuff that's been found there, and, you know, dating back to the times of Columba, St. Donan, you know, all this kind of thing. There's St. Columba's well there, around the other side of the island, mind you. But still, the point is Grúlin. So in the 1850s, a tenant farmer came in from the borders of Scotland, a sheep farmer, and his condition for taking the tenancy from the lairds of the islands, who were this sort of Scottish family, the Clan Ranalds, his condition for taking up that tenancy was that he got Grúlin cleared. So in several days, families that had been the descendants of folk who'd lived there for sort of centuries were just absolutely removed in about 1853 to suit that man. And he himself left after 4 years. You know, it's that kind of thing that hits me every time, because it's these, once you sort of destabilize systems that have managed to find ways to operate well in difficult circumstances, they're destabilized on a whim, on a kind of just trying to grab some, as it turns out, you know, passing thing for an incomer who would never settle there. But that's the end. Gruelin was then empty. And for those long years I visited and went up the Skua every time I was there, I'd look down on Gruelin with all these massive chunks of the basalt that have fallen from the cliff face sitting interspersed with the clear outline of the old black houses that were just left in a day and just deserted pretty much. And this time I walked round to just, you know, just get the crack and see the place. And saw this little buggy come in, electric powered, because thanks to Egg Electric, everything's electric powered now, which is the way of the future. With Sarah on it, her two bairns and a sheepdog in the back, bouncing along the track, because for the first time in a very long time, there is now stock back on Gruelin. She is a farmer and she's putting sheep back. Okay, her dad thinks it would be better to have cattle. They're not sure if this will help keep the bracken down. They're not sure quite how far the sheep will wander around the island. They're not sure, but they're going ahead with it. Yeah. And what really struck me, because it struck me so much about the Nordic countries when I visit them, is that they're not sure and they do it anyway. It's the biggest difference between us and them, because we need to be sure all the time before we give stuff a shot. And what's happening there is people aren't sure, but they're doing it anyway. And actually, as they're going, they're learning, they're testing stuff out. They're testing stuff in a real situation. There's an expansion of the Isle of Egg Brewery, which is now Lag Bay Brewery, which is now moving to a new site thanks to crowdfunding. It's apparently Scotland's first cooperatively owned brewery because shares were issued in it. And it's just assembling all the bits and pieces. It just needs the building warrant for building to be able to start. So it's ready to go. And it's got incredibly ambitious plans to pull electricity down from a little mini hydro that will be up on the you know, one of the peaks beside it. I mean, this is how every community, especially in the Highlands, should be able to think, because the resource that's sitting around them in terms of energy is unbelievable, but it belongs to one, you know, state agency. It belongs to one feudal landowner. It belongs to one private, you know, it's not something that that most communities can collect and then decide to use. And then finally, I spent a day getting blooming slashed to bits going round seeing all the tree planting that there's been. And I remember, you know, lots of the older folk when I arrived, many of them, the original Gaelic speakers of the island, furious really about the amount of wrong placement of trees. But yeah, which is now, you know, again, people are actually contesting that now that they've been in and about it. It's maybe the more wrong types of trees. But anyway, a lot of them have been taken out and they've since planted 17,000 trees just quietly. Creating the only native tree nursery on the Scottish Islands, just quietly, collecting something like 2,000 acorns from an obliging crofter near Arisaig because there weren't enough oaks on Egg, and collecting seeds for all these different types of trees, native trees, to put totally different forestry back again through the ever encroaching bracken on the sides of Egg. So they're getting to grips, I mean, literally getting to grips with this island in every conceivable way. And I just was left speechless with just admiration and fondness and wow, you know, about the whole thing. And then, of course, speechless because it was blimmin' boiling. It was the day I left, it was 21 degrees here when I left and 16 degrees on Egg and, you know, it felt freezing. Then it rapidly went the other way around. So it was 27 to 28 degrees every day. And it kind of, everybody was down on the beach and swimming, because, you know, especially in my case of a wee bothy with one wall glass faced, it was boiling, you know. So so there was, it was like blooming California, you know, I'll see you down on the beach. Everybody was kind of laughing at that, you know, but actually you had to keep dipping in because it was the only way to keep cool. So what an extraordinary week, and just blissful, really.
It sounds fabulous. I'll bore folk near the end, but with the daft things that I did. But it was reflecting on the past as well, because it was 25 years, you know, since the egg project, you know, began, and that just sounds amazing. And I was thinking back to 1969, bizarrely, because of a couple of things I did during my wee break. But it was, again, things that come out of that, land ownership. And the other thing that comes out of it was reflecting on the experience that shared with Scots and Irish in terms of removal from their native land and forced migration and asylum seeking, which is, you know, one of your latest articles that you wrote, Leslie. And it just seems to me this is a defining issue of our time in terms of the difference between the UK government and the Scottish government, but not just that, and the potential of what is going on in politically and ideologically in England and Scotland, and the differences that are highlighted by the reaction to refugees and asylum seekers, which I think you pointed out quite clearly, and things I just didn't know about at all, and I think I'm well read in terms of the new Scots strategy that the Scottish government has implemented, and I think was fabulous.
Yeah, well, it was mostly because in the wake of Kenmure Street, which really, you know, blew me away, I was trying to do a wee film about that at the suggestion of one of the guys who'd made a film. He was the one that shot the film from his, I think, second floor flat. We then rapidly discovered nobody wanted to speak to us, right? And it wasn't just the usual thing. I think it was quite a kind of concerted thing where actually there's a sort of learned caution now amongst everyone within these networks. But then speaking to Alison Phipps, who's the professor of refugee integration at Glasgow University, now there in itself is an unusual thing. It became apparent there was just a lot of donkey work behind the scenes that had created all of this. So tracing it back, basically, when Glasgow, so people will remember, I certainly remember a lot of asylum seekers arriving, because I remember being out the day after the murder of Firzit Dagh, who was a refugee way back, I think it was 2001, when this dispersal program began. So it wasn't that everything was, you know, in any way sweetness and light. That was a real tough time. Lots of resentment amongst local people in Springburn to what they thought was kind of people being able to jump their way through hoops in housing that they were stuck at the bottom of, all sorts of social difficulty there. And you would never have expected very much good could come of this. But because there was an ability to do something, it probably started actually not with governments, but pretty much with people. There was the first sets of home of dawn raids began to prompt the beginnings of forming networks to support people. That was maybe 2004, 2005. Obviously, the Glasgow girls came out of that. Most people will have heard of that, especially since one of their number became an MSP in the recent elections. But they decided to try and campaign to stop one of their friends from Drumchapel High School and her family being lifted and deported. And they were successful in the end. They hung on it and got Agnesa Morselia freed. So that then kind of created a bit of a focus. And all the time, these kind of networks were forming all around Scotland to support other asylum seekers who were waiting to hear whether or not they would get refugee status. So that then led to, much later in 2014, the Scottish government decided it was going to do something quite different to the Scottish, to the British default on refugees and asylum seekers. And that was basically this new Scots policy, so that And it's an important distinction that people, I've often jumbled them up. Obviously, refugees have got status. They can stay. Asylum seekers are waiting. They don't know yet. And so what had happened is, and people know this, asylum seekers can be sitting forever, 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 and they're not able to work. So the new Scots policy, the difference about it was that they would be supported to integrate into communities from day one of arrival and not just once leave to remain has been granted. So basically, that is, we're not really caring whether you're eventually likely to get, you know, you're not going to be left in some terrible, isolated situation on Scotland's watch, waiting for the Home Office to finally flip through your case. We're going to treat you like you're in until we hear that there's any evidence you're out. And even then, there's a lot of people still sitting here whilst appeals and so on are heard. So anyway, the point was this new Scots strategy brought loads of people together. It's all the usual suspects, the councils, the charities, statutory bodies, faith groups, refugee council, but also academics, which was actually turned out to be a wizard wheeze, because they brought in people, particularly Alison I've just mentioned, and her colleagues from Queen Margaret University, Alison Strang, Alistair Ager. And these guys were instrumental in placing social bonds at the heart of this policy. This might sound a bit waffly, but the point is, I mean, as Alison put it, she said, social bonds create neighbours who meet, greet and eat with each other. And that's what keeps people safe when state structures fail. Now think about Kenmure Street.
Yeah.
What was that all about? That was about social bonds where people spotted something happening to guys they knew, neighbours, and acted really quickly. And that's the next bit, because these networks have now been working for 20 years. And at the beginning, maybe there was, you know, local Scots heading it up. Actually, now it's the generation of the first asylum seekers who have been sufficiently empowered by this whole new Scots thing that they themselves are now leading these networks. So there's tremendous people in it, some of whom I would love to meet, and because of the lockdown never did. But like Pinar Aksu, she leads the Maryhill Integration Network. And she was the one who read the agreement that was achieved at Kenmure Street when the two detainees were released, right? So that was quite a big moment. And that's the kind of involvement now that's been created by refugees who have been able to get off their knees into society and empowered enough to start leading these networks and keep other new Scots safe. So here's what has been quietly created. And the list, I mean, ironically, it was when I was an egg that I was hearing from a friend of mine who runs the Scottish Islands Network, all these examples, great examples you never hear of, all the businesses that have been started by refugees, you know, and particularly Argyll and Bute, you know, which had 21 families on Bute. Now, there was problems at the beginning there, and that's all that people may have lodged in their head about that. There's been, you know, it's been extraordinary, the success story there is there. There's, you know, award-winning takeaways run. In fact, one guy, a Syrian project manager, and his wife had been contributing food to a local market stall. Everyone was raving about the food. So they've started a takeaway. It's called the Ryan in Rothsay. Similarly, there's another award-winning patisserie run by a Syrian chap. And the one that I love is an upholstery firm called Edris, which is based in Stornoway, and it's basically upcycling old furniture by beautifully reupholstering it using all sorts of different materials, but mostly local Harris tweed. And that guy had an upholstery business in Homs for 30 years. Now, who wants to throw that away? Because he's now employing islanders. All these people are employing islanders around them, and all of this is put at risk by what Priti Patel and her new hostile environment is trying to do. I mean, you know, we've been through this before about stripping refugees of the right to settle permanently if they arrive spontaneously and all that stuff. But, you know, this could well be the first real flashpoint in the autumn, when clearly the sort of two directions these two different governments are taking are completely laid bare. Because how long will it be okay for this integrated you know, sort of human way of dealing with people. How long will that be able to continue when the bill that we talked about before, you know, Priti Patel's nationality and borders bill, got its second reading, so it's due to get its third reading, then it becomes law. And then they, you know, that overarching policy sits, because it's a reserved policy to Westminster, that sits over a cloud over everything that's been achieved in Scotland. So, you know, people will have to fight for the right to party or stand up for everyone in our midst and our way of doing things on this.
Yeah, because, I mean, it's another one of these populist policies that have been introduced for to appeal to this very certain specific electorate. I mean, it is absolutely, I mean, we're at a UK low in terms of asylum seeking. And the constant reference to illegal asylum seekers, I mean, there is no such thing as an illegal asylum seeker. None whatsoever. In the Refugee Convention that the UK signed up to, that does not exist. You're an asylum seeker. That is it, full stop. And we've got to the ludicrous point where the chief executive of the Royal National Lifeboat Institution is having to come out and defend the policy of humanitarianism of rescuing asylum seekers who are crossing the channel in boats, and having to defend lifeboat men and women who are bringing these asylum seekers ashore. And the BBC was very interesting about this, because it said, or they've been told, they were telling the asylum seekers, the mob that was there, to go back to France. No, and I'm going to have to put explicit up on this, they were telling the asylum seekers to fuck off back to France. You know, we've now got the point where the lifeboat institution is being pilloried as well by Nigel Farage, who's calling it a taxi service for illegal immigration. I mean, it just seems to me that we've got to a point where you've got people like Nigel Farage and Darren Grimes and all these right-wing ideologues who are now mainstream, and they're coming out against the lifeboat people. And I do not recognise the society that comes from. And secondly, the other aspect of it as well is that we talk about the Nordics all the time, and very, very positive, where the UK is in negotiations with Denmark, apparently, to create an offshore asylum centre in Rwanda, you know? And that's the point we've got to. And you're absolutely right, Leslie. Will the Scottish government stand up to the UK government? And even if they do stand up, given the reserve powers, will it make a blind bit of difference? We were tied to the UK and this appalling piece of legislation. It was introduced purely, as I can see, as part of its ongoing culture wars about the others. And it's appealing to that horrific demographic. I'm speechless about it. I mean, and that doesn't happen often with me, but I'm so bitterly angry about the fact of bairns and mothers and families coming, being forced to cross in these boats because of the lack of an opportunity for official methods of seeking asylum in the UK. And that being the issue, not the fact of why the UK is turning its back on asylum seekers and considering these appalling theoretical solutions.
Mm-hmm. And I guess my point with this column was just to say, you can't support what you don't know too much about. And this would be my only quibble with the kind of huge desire to keep quite secret the activities of the networks that operate to support people. I totally see that, totally see the need to kind of, although I imagine the Home Office pretty much knows who's who by now, but still, the difficulty is that if Scots don't realise just quite what a success story, and this is another thing Alison was telling me about, when she's talking, you know, on Zoom or even going in the past to conferences around the world, Scotland is seen as the world leader in integrating refugees.
Who knew?
Exactly, who knew, right? So, you know, this is quite something. And that's like, get this, folks. You know, most of the time we're talking about stuff where Scotland is, especially in comparison to the Nordics, you know, is kind of a couple of steps down. We're a lot of steps up on this one. And it's a quiet success story that we should be extremely proud of. But we can only be ready to defend something if we really understand what has been achieved. And that's not to say everything's blooming brilliant. Yep. You know, of course, there's racism and there's difficulty and all the rest of it. But nonetheless, we've got something there. Let's get ready to defend it, because it looks like, you know, yeah, the flashpoints are coming.
Yeah, well, if we're held up as a terrific example of refugee integration, unfortunately, and what we are not a terrific example of is following a Nordic system. And I remember you working on this. I mean, when you and I were working together, when I was working with you on Riddick Questions, you'd just finished the report, the McLeish report, I think it was finally entitled, on the Scottish prison system, and looking at the Finnish system, which was presenting alternatives to actually throwing people in jail. And nothing has happened. Nothing has happened. It appears to be a failing system, which is, you know, playing into the hands again of the populace, with Boris Johnson, this latest statement about chain gangs and high-vis jackets, you know, which is again playing into that narrative of put people in jail because we can't think of anything else to do with them. And you've outlined why this is happening, and again, possibly the fears, you know, the error terror that you referred to, which is restricting the ability to use community service orders as opposed to putting people in prison.
Yeah. I mean, basically, back whenever it was, 13 years ago, the Scottish government, new SNP government, was looking at the fact that England and Scotland imprison three times more people than all our neighbours with the same crime rate.
Yeah.
Now, you know, when you have a sort of graph, you get the whole of the rest of Europe, Scotland and England, and probably Wales and Northern Ireland, but, you know, Britain, basically, and then America. And, you know, we don't want to be anywhere near the American system. You know, most people realize the number of black men. I mean, it's been highlighted finally by Black Lives Matter, but the number of black, young black men imprisoned is unbelievable, right? And the next stop is us.
Yeah.
So there's the challenge that was laid down. Why is this happening? And, you know, you've got to keep asking yourself this, because people will keep finding individual circumstances that justify prison for sure. But what we found out during that time of going about was definitely, and I remember this very vividly from one prison governor who said, you know, quite despairingly, that basically we are imprisoning, we are criminalizing nuisance behavior.
Yeah.
So, I mean, now this is not to diminish how life-sapping nuisance behavior is. And nuisance is probably a kind of aggravating word to anyone who's living with antisocial behavior. Yeah. Anywhere in their midst, I totally do get that. But prison, you know, as the kind of remedy for that, I mean, every piece of research now shows it's never the remedy. I mean, people know this, you know, but the kind of academies of crime, the revolving door. And so there was a kind of set of recommendations which were adopted. And largely it was after a trip to Finland, which had fully adopted this community payback idea. The Scots were first to do this in Britain. I went to many conferences myself where English prison reformers were kind of almost, I mean, you know, I mean, as again, I think I've said this before about going to a North of England conference after the first Indy Ref and being like a sort of female Che Guevara in terms of total coolness. But there's another place you were pretty cool. I mean, shamefully, really, because little had happened. But within the British penal setup and the sort of punitive kind of atmosphere that surrounded prisons and prisoners for blooming ever, pretty much, the Scots had nudged themselves out of it with a kind of, look, we're going to try and change the direction of travel. Now, with the difficulty that's really happening is that legislation and governments can't direct sheriffs, judges and some magistrates to use community alternatives. And it was apparent again way back then when we spoke to some that a lot of sheriffs just didn't believe in it. They believed that prison worked. They thought community stuff was soft. And I know a lot of the public think the same. And sometimes even weird things, particularly in the case of one woman that we met in Cornton Vale, One sheriff thought she might get some proper treatment for depression in Courton Vale that wasn't available in her community. So all sorts of strange things are just beginning to push this on. But I mean, this is now just ridiculous. We have got a remand crisis happening right now. Now, again, people need that these words unpacked a bit, because remand, you know, what is that? But this is really where people are awaiting sometimes trial, sometimes sentence. They could be released on bail, but increasingly and automatically, the Crown is apparently asking for them to be kept in jail on remand. Now, remember, they're not guilty. You know, and in fact, something like 70% of the women who are ever put on remand don't end up with a sentence. So this is people being banged away. And during COVID, that's 23 hours a day, very often, banged up in cells without being found guilty. They're always at the back of the queue for anything, education, sports activity, just walking around the yard. They can't join work programs, a bit like asylum seekers. And they're also living day to day without any idea of when they'll be released. Now, you know, one person I spoke to just said it's mental torture, just plain and simple, that. And it blasts these fragile life arrangements people have to smithereens, especially for mothers.
Yeah.
It's quite possible for a woman to arrive in court expecting to be home, placed on remand, and nobody collects her child from school. You know, and so the social services will step in if they can't find the relays quickly enough. And that's that family absolutely snookered. That remember, 70% of those women will eventually be released, either because they're not found not guilty or because their offences don't even carry a prison sentence. Because there was also, at the time of the McLeish Commission, there was the presumption against prison sentences for anything that was less than a year, as it's turned out now. So, you know, today in the news, there's a report about the unsatisfactory nature of lots of the physical environment. I think it's Greenock Jail has got leaks all over the place and it's basically fallen to pieces, has a 10-year wait for it to get to the top of the queue for a new jail, even though they've got the land to build on. So it's kind of pretty grim, really, because essentially we're still jailing people for nuisance behaviour. And the craziness of it is, I mean, here's Audit Scotland, right? Housing a prisoner costs 37,000 quid. A community sentence costs 2,000 quid.
Yeah. And you would have thought at that point, the Conservative opposition in Holyrood would say, that makes absolute economic sense. Let's go with this one. But Jamie Green, their shadow justice spokesperson, he thinks the Scottish Government is too soft. His solution is, let's jail more folk. Let's throw more in jail.
Yeah. And this is obviously what Boris Johnson has latched onto. Well, it's interesting because it's not more folk in jail from Boris. It's all sorts of what you would call diversion schemes, the community payback, which is actually the English then adopted. So there's 100,000 people on community payback in England at the moment, maybe not with the orange fizz jackets. And, you know, so this is not a new thing that Boris is kind of even suggesting for England. But they have the same prisons crisis, kind of with knobs on, because they've also had disastrous private prisons and a disastrous privatised bail system that they had to kind of just call a halt to. So all of this sort of doesn't really work. The question really comes down to, of course, the judiciary have to be free to make their own decisions about what they think best, whether somebody goes to a community sentence or whether they go to jail. But, you know, there's been an attempt to make a legislative shift 13 years ago, which numerically hasn't changed the balance of things at all. And, you know, how does that work then? I mean, how can we encourage more use of community sentences? And I imagine some sheriffs will say, well, blooming put some more money into them so that they're absolutely tungsten options that we can use. But as with everything, I'm mindful still of egg, you've got to start off trying things out. If there's ever a problem, and of course that's what you were referring to, this error terror. This terrible case of Craig McClellan, who was stabbed to death by a guy who'd removed his electric tag. Yeah. And that suddenly you saw the number of tags, electric tags, going absolutely crashing down. 3 years ago, 300 folk released on tags, 41 today. So one mistake like that creates a complete terror of following and having that bad news come back to haunt you. And that's totally understandable. And yet, you know, all the evidence suggests that electronic tags actually do work. So I don't know. It's a thing as well of when you look at the number of tough bits of things we're going to have to take on as a set of people. You know, we can't just do more knee-jerk stuff here. We have to look at what evidence tells us actually works. And we've got to try and drive in that direction. I mean, I'm very mindful. I was watching Channel 4 News last night with these kind of reports of now. Well, I mean, we know this, but the really informed academic and expert view about climate change, what we've seen of this extreme weather in the last month, all the predictions now, you know, summer heat waves over 40 degrees centigrade, extreme weather the norm, and the UK is not prepared. You know, all of this is like there's a sense of urgency which we can't be shielded from anymore. Lots of stuff we've just told and thought, oh, we'll just muddle along and all this kind of thing. We've got to now step up and try and just let go of any emotional stuff that's clouding our vision. And we need bloody political leaders, since we've already crashed the sweary barrier. We need leaders who will not pull their punches and soft soap us and try and kind of just palm the voters off with the stuff that just keeps them distracted and blaming others and divided and all this nonsense. We really do need now incredibly inspiring and brave political leadership.
Well, absolutely. I would just say that I think the quote you gave from Karen McCluskey, Community Justice Scotland, summed it up brilliantly. We must jail those who make us afraid, not those who make us mad. And I think that was, that hit the nail absolutely on the head. Why do we put people in prison? And to take a step back, you're right about leadership, because we now, moving swiftly on, there's two stories that come rushing in here. Both you and Ruth Davidson, my God, I nearly said it. Oh dear me, the Baroness herself. Both you and Ruth Wishart were writing about the Liberal Democrats, and of course we've got Alex Cole, Mr. Sweary himself, Hamilton, who's now punting himself to replace a man who I find very genial, you know, and very affable, and where I've met him, most personable, Willie Rennie, the man who is who's never ashamed of the daft photo opportunity as leader of the Liberal Democrats. And you asked, what is the point of the Liberal Democrats? Because, I mean, I was just thinking to myself, they must be aware that, like Ian Murray, they're the go-to folk purely in Scotland for the anti-SNP, anti-independence vote. That is their raison d'être. That is it. Their policies, I don't know if anybody's really terribly interested in their policies. I mean, they keep continually punting federalism. But the rest of it, I think you made a very coherent argument. It was other than providing that buffer for disaffected Tories, usually, to keep the SNP out in places like North East Fife, what is the point of the Liberal Democrats in Scotland?
Yeah, and I mean, to be fair, actually, I mean, I think we're coming. You want to talk about the Green Queen or the not Green Queen?
I had that. Actually, you see, your rotten dog there. I had a little bit there. I was going to stick in.
No, but I know. I'm saying I'm not stealing your fire, my dear. I'm only pointing out that it was a Lib Dem researcher who found out some of what you're about to get into. So, I mean, when you're asking what the Scottish Lib Dems for, well, actually, fair play. That was a good piece of research by that researcher. My question, and I know an awful lot of a lot of people are very riled by Alex Cole Hamilton. My God, you know, I mean, you can kind of sit and go through the number of things that, you know, he kind of mouthed the swearies at Marie Todd. He's got a kind of just manner issue that's just riling to a lot of people, which is a strange characteristic for a party that always was seen as the open-toed sandaled kind of, you know, aspect of politics. Because obviously that kind of irritating factor Jo Swinson had absolutely perfected, you know. And really, I hate being personal about things, but I just, anyway, we've been there. So the point more was really, what is this whole party for now? I mean, of course, you could level that question perhaps at, you know, at all of them. But,
yeah,
but particularly the Lib Dems, given that you're now sitting trying to sort of, you know, claim some moral authority to lead four MSPs, jings, you know, and that's a real collapse because, I mean, people may not remember, but back in 2010, the Scottish Lib Dems had 16 MSPs, then it went to 5, and now, lordy, lordy, after 10 years of Willie Rennie, who is a very pleasant guy, it's 4, right? Now, that's not just personalities. And this is the thing, everybody wants to have a good old go at Cole Hamilton. Well, fine, knock yourselves out. But, you know, in politics, there's bigger fish to fry than the personalities that lead things. They don't manage to overcome the problems of a party that is known now only for betraying its principles.
Yeah.
And you say, you know, there that the Lib Dems talk about federalism. I don't think they do, actually. I don't think I can recall them taking any moment mm-hmm. where they had profile or publicity or center stage and using it to argue coherently and bravely for a different kind of Britain, or bothering their arse to turn up at conferences where people like Joanna Cherry and myself turn up to debate the future constitution of the UK. Where were they? You know, nowhere. None of these guys who are supposedly so passionate about the third way for Britain and all the rest of it, none of them are ever there. So, you know, it's more really that there's no vision, there's no reason. And actually, when you think back to a lot of, you know, you could think back to, of course, the Condemn coalition that just knackered them, mm-hmm. you know. That absolutely kind of, you know, crucified the Lib Dems. But, you know, if you go back even further than that, I was sort of reminded really about the difficulties that faced the last Liberal governments way back in the 1880s when they were trying to cobble together a Home Rule yeah. Bill for Ireland. They were defeated. I mean, Gladstone started it, defeated by, you know, unionists within his own party. In fact, the Liberal Party split at that point to have Liberal unionists stand against the Liberal Party. So that he ended his career, and indeed he died without having managed to put together a successful Home Rule Bill for Ireland. It was then carried on to the next and final Liberal government. And of course, that then cruised mm-hmm. neatly into the First World War and all the history that then almost inevitably unraveled. But, you know, if there had been an attempt, if it had been possible to do something and to have put forward Home Rule for Ireland, of clearly it wouldn't have stopped the move towards Irish independence, but it could have, you know, who knows, it could have changed yeah. the nature of that whole horrible struggle, the violence that surrounded it. It could have, here's the point, provided a template for Scotland, because once there had been Home Rule for Ireland, well, do. And it's just possible Liberals could have transformed Britain into a federal state 130 yeah. years ago, is my point, yeah. right? And because that failed, you know, because even that sticking plaster, which Home Rule always was for Ireland, wasn't even acceptable within the British context. Not just did Home Rule fail to happen and all that then went on, unionism came back with a vengeance then, just sort of shutting down even these kind of options, which just propelled Ireland further along its way. And key point, the Liberal Party destroyed itself
yeah.
as a governing party. And since then, it has not had a big idea, a vision, a reason. It'll keep talking about federalism without really coming good on it. It will talk about renewable energy and then have Ed Davey, who didn't do anything
yes.
to, you know, connect Scotland's islands up to subsea connectors. And conveniently, Sir Ed Davey, of course, because he took a gong from the Tories after losing his seat, you know, with the coalition stuff behind him. But Ed Davey, who joined the PR firm that represents EDF Energy, which got the contract to build Hinkley Point nuclear power station from Ed Davey, right? Yeah. So, you know, they've lost credibility. It's not just the stuff we all know about the student fees, you know, the tuition fees mm-hmm. and all the rest of it. It's like that was a huge chunk of what they were about, federalism. No, nobody's buying that. A huge chunk of what they were about, renewable energy. No, you didn't do anything when you had the chance. The Greens have got that now. And then this kind of blooming business on Brexit, you know, where Joe had that brash bollocks to Brexit policy. The only reason that she was able to promise that the Lib Dems would revoke Article 50 without another referendum if they were elected, the only reason she was able to do that is because other people, other politicians, Joanna Cherry, Andy Whiteman, other SNP, Labour and Green politicians got together and did that legal action without a Lib Dem, because they decided not to join it because there was a problem. They got a knockback after the first crowdfunding session. So, you know, this is pathetic, because they then, of course, after the whole business of Europe was another of these massive issues that was really at the core of the whole liberal cause. Well, they dumped it then, you know, because as soon as it looked like kind of, you know, get Brexit done was the order of the day, suddenly opposition to Brexit was just dumped. So this is why I'm asking, what are the Lib Dems for? Because everything they've held dear and held aloft, they've failed to get over the line. You could chuck in, you know, proportional representation, but we've done that to death. But these other kind of issues have all been taken up by parties who are able to, well, mostly the Greens actually, have managed to convince people that they have an actual knitted together strategy and dedication to these goals, which the Lib Dems have lost. So now they are for nothing. They are just for, if you don't really want to vote Tory in a douce area like North East Fife, you don't have to hold your nose that hard. You can vote for the Lib Dems and the Tories will just quietly sidle in and make sure he gets over the line.
Yeah.
And that's not even going to last that long. So the Lib Dems are looking for a total wipeout. And what does Alex Cole Hamilton, since he will almost inevitably be the leader and probably the only candidate, you know, what has he got to offer to this, suggesting that Nicola Sturgeon doesn't have a mandate to hold IndyRef 2?
Yeah.
It's so beyond pathetic, I couldn't hardly even bring myself to actually focus on that aspect of it, because for a man who wants to lead a party that has the two words liberal and Democrat in the title, how you can look at the current situation, not hear Gladstone, Lloyd George, Asquith, all the past of your own blooming party ringing in your ears about how you tore yourselves apart over not being able to meet the aspirations, the democratic aspirations of a nation in the centuries past, and not see that rewriting itself now, will hell mend you.
Yeah, because I mean, I think the only thing that Cole Hamilton's got left him when reading his statements was the fact of a potential coalition with Labour. Well, there's a hoot. And the tainted narrative, I'm like you, I was thinking, what the heck does he mean, the tainted mandate? And I couldn't believe what was actually claiming was that during the election campaign, the SNP apparently stopped talking about independence and then talked about Nicola Sturgeon's ability to lead to lead Scotland through the COVID and post-COVID crisis. I'm thinking, well, that's how many angels can dance on the head of a pin, Alex, if you're saying that taints a mandate. And when Joe Swinton was talking about, oh, let's bollocks the Brexit, that was based upon the fact of getting a mandate by being elected as part of a government, you know, being in government. That gives you the mandate in a democratic system. That's your mandate, is being elected on a platform. And I thought, he's definitely going for that. Is he going to just solidify that minority position and keep himself and his three pals as MSPs in Holyrood? I think that's it. That's the limit of his ambition. And he will play to that audience.
Well, I see, because if they were anything like the Lib Dems of yore, you know, he could have used this time to push this federal idea.
Absolutely.
You know, there's your platform. You get, as you're a Lib Dem, you get one moment in of glory, two perhaps, one when you announce your candidacy for leadership, and two when you win and get a nanosecond of interest from everybody else. And if you don't use that to try and push forward your different vision for the whole future of the United Kingdom, you're toast.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but as I say, that was the point of Liberal Democrats. It was, as you referred to earlier, that there is a shining moment of glory for, and we'll name it, Lily Humphreys, who's a researcher for the Scottish Lib Dems, who was the one who used the Freedom of Information application to get the skinny on what had been going on and what had happened behind the scenes in terms of something we've talked about before, which is this Crown Consent, which we spoke about before, and which came out of the Balmoral having its business rates reduced so it pays less than the local primary school. And that led on to the fact of the Duchy of Cornwall and Prince Charles being exempted from the right to buy legislation for for homeowners who wish to buy their homes outright. But he was the leaseholder in the Duchy of Cornwall. He got exemption from that. It came out of that in England and the UK that there had been over 1,000 times that Prince Charles and the Queen had intervened and lobbied on their own behalf. And this latest one, you know, is to do with the heat and energy bill, which heat networks bill, which was going to allow companies and public organisations to compulsorily purchase land in order to install pipelines for green energy. Lo and behold, the monarch got wind of this, her lawyers, and I think that was an interesting point, the complete statement, the as if she didn't know about it, you know, her lawyers intervened and lobbied. I would presume if you were a solicitor, you'd be instructed by your client to actually to intervene on this, but on your client's behalf to be exempt from this. The monarch had got sight of it, her lawyers had got sight of this proposed legislation. Now, Paul Whitehouse, who was then the
Wheelhouse.
Paul, where did I get Paul Whitehouse from?
Well, it could be an amalgam of many things, but don't lose your way.
No. Yes, I'll get back to it. But Paul Wheelhouse, that's what a fortnight's holiday does for me. I lose my thread on names. But he was the Energy Secretary at the time, introduced an amendment specifically excluding the Crown lands and Crown estates from this piece of legislation. Lo and behold, who was the only person who raised any objections at the time was your good friend and outstanding campaigner, Andy Whiteman, who said, hang on here, what's going on? It passed. The point was at that he did not let Holyrood know at that point that the Scottish government had given sight of legislation to the Crown and they had been lobbied to remove the necessity for the Crown to be covered by this legislation, thus exempting the Green Queen and from this legislation. And it's apparently it's 67 times this has happened that we did not know about. And that is the position at the head of private ownership of land and the stratification of our society, that the monarch effectively has a veto in the 21st century over legislation that applies to them on the basis that it affects their private property and, wait for this one, their interests. Now, that's as broad a definition as you can possibly get. No, it's going to affect my private property. Yeah, I may object to it, but that is at least defined, but affects the interests of the Crown. You know, that is effectively a veto on anything that they can justify as being in their interest. The other thing that I discovered on this as well is that just a side issue, but they're also exempt and they've been exempt from the police investigation and searching of Crown properties for any looted artefacts that may have been looted in the Empire. So really? There you go. Yeah, that's the sort of thing. So everybody else, you know, looted artifacts, you know, and it's stuff like this that just actually embodies to me the position of the monarchy and the way it frames everything and the potential it has in an independent Scotland, if we don't sort it out, to frame everything that happens in an independent Scotland. Are we going to still have Crown Assent? I don't know. Well, it just seems to be that the Scottish government, because it's bounded by this current legislation, is quite willing to go along with it and quite willing to go along with it. The point is, in secret. But thanks to Lily Humphreys, whose name I did get right, we now know about this. And it's yet again another. It's absolutely scandalous in the 21st century that we should be governed and bound by this outmoded Crown Assent.
Yeah, because if you look at it the other way, here's a different way that the monarchy could look at this. As we look at the catastrophic warnings about climate change and coming up to COP26, as if they live here too, you know, as if they're part of this society, they could be the pioneers in allowing pipes, you know, for district heating or whatever to go through there. And they could have the bloody film crews in, you know, showing here's what the modern monarchy is willing to do, you know, to let. But no, this is a default. It's a default that they get a hands off on everything. And, you know, I'm thinking about Cameron McNeish, you know, resigned from the SNP for many reasons last week. But one of them was the lack of activity on land reform and on raptor persecution. Now, a lot of people will sort of think, oh, what? Well, you know, in the previous thing that I did about national parks, so many people were talking to me about the fact that big areas of the Cairngorm Park Authority, notably Balmoral and its neighbouring estates, have got all sorts of problems with deer numbers remaining high. That limits natural regeneration, and poisoned birds of prey have been found on land around the royal estates, but there's no action to do anything about that. So it's like behind the scenes, you get the sense when you start to look at any of the issues that get close to Balmoral, there's a complete hands off in all sorts of supposedly democratically controlled bits of our society. And this is kind of, you know, it's disgusting. People who are close enough to know the ins and outs of it, people like, really good people like Cameron McNeish. So, yeah, it's missed opportunities. It's the old hierarchy still pulling the strings behind the scenes. It's the knowledge that we're heading towards needing to have a completely different attitude towards everything green, where it's basically, I hate to use this phrase given Donald Trump, but a Trump card that gets played now on top of everything to give it a boosted urgency, the kind of boosted urgency that the pandemic has done, which, of course, we know Prince Charles, you know, broke the rules of. Mm-hmm. You know, we have to stop having this kind of here's the rules and then the royals just walk sweetly in the opposite direction. And it's presumed, you know. So, yeah, for all sorts of reasons, this is well bad and well good to have seen brought to light.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was, yeah. You know, I just operate, maybe I'm naive, I just continually operate on the basis that our governance is better up here, even though I have significant difficulties with certain areas of SNP government policy. But it just, you know.
Yeah, but that's that's the mystery about all of this.
Yeah.
Is why an SNP government would be kind of tugging its forelock towards the royals in this. But again, I mean, although you're discounting the role of lawyers, that again has become a real trope within lots of different criticisms of the Scottish government, that they're very led by the what if legal brigade, who basically are constantly worried about what happens if the status quo is amended or changed. So I've no doubt that Paul Wheelhouse will have been blooming inundated with all sorts of legal advice about if we do this, this sets a precedent. I remember, you know, being for a while leading a little task force on transferring land on the island of Rum beside Egg to community control. And it was a very fascinating little dip into the attitudes of the civil service, who were, despite the fact that there was leadership, political leadership from Mike Russell at the time, who was Environment Secretary, saying, we want this to happen. When it came to making it happen, the civil service were guys that we were working with were absolutely paranoid about setting a precedent for all sorts of other people being able to argue that land should be transferred to them. Of course, as an evil land reformer, I was rather kind of happy at the prospect that we were creating a slight little chink there that other people might march through. But sadly, the way that the world works is there is so little uptake of these kind of precedents by people. And the point was, to make stuff move, you have to start creating new ways of working. So it was only the deadline of an application for a lottery fund that required these islanders to own, to be proved that they had that ownership of the land, that finally forced their hand to do something that was absolutely against their instincts. And so I'd imagine that all of this is at work on a minister who then needs to be really blooming single-minded and tough and supported by other ministers around him to be able to decide, no, that's enough, actually. You know, rules are rules. And what is the evidence that there's any big threat to you, your safety or anything else by workmen putting a blooming pipe through Balmoral?
Yeah.
Which then suggests the rest of the cabinet are equally thrilled to this. You know, a lawyer raises a small point that there might be some kind of difficulty, and that's enough to just stop any move away to having rules that apply to everybody.
Well, the other aspect of it is that the Scottish government seems quite happy in certain circumstances to take a punt on legislation, and in other circumstances, not happy. So, you know, they pick and choose where they're going to listen to lawyers in there. And that leads quite neatly onto comparing and contrasting what I did during the holidays. I watched, in addition to this, the trial of the Chicago 7, which I can recommend to people. I don't know if you've seen it, Leslie, the movie. Absolutely
nope.
Fantastic. Written by Aaron Sorkin, which is about what happened post the Democratic Convention. In 1969, and the trial of the Chicago 7, including Tom Hayden, Jerry Rubin, etc., Abby Hoffman. It terrific piece, brilliantly written. And if people see it, what I can recommend that you do is you take a step back from, which was a piece of drama, and I'm a sucker for courtroom drama anyway, which is a piece of drama, and actually look at what the reality of what happened, which is even more horrifying in terms of the way the trial was conducted. But I recommend it to you. And it took me back to 1969. I was in the States and then on this wee scholarship I was lucky enough to get, and it was a life-changing experience for me. I didn't get to go to Woodstock. I missed the summer of Seoul, which was up in Harlem, and I missed it the second time round. They phoned up the DCA, and I should have known better, being Dundee, you know. I phoned up the DCA to try and get a couple of tickets to go and see it. Sold out virtually immediately. Mm-hmm. And it looks like a fantastic film with all the best soul and funk performers there were in 1969 appearing. And the movie footage had been lost, and it's now been put together. It was also the summer of landing, the moon landing. And I reflected on that because unlike most of my mates, I was very again the whole moon project. I was again nipping off into space, and it led me back to listening to Gil Scott Heron, "Whitey on the Moon." Was a fabulous piece of poetry and music that Gil Scott Heron wrote in the aftermath of the moon landing. So it was a. It was that was my little trip back to 1969. But to focus on the Chicago 7, when I was there, I was staying in Kentucky, and the university there, and we got taken to Fort Knox, which most people know is the repository of the gold bullion. But what I didn't know until I got there was actually a training facility for the armored division, and I was walking through there in an incredibly privileged position, and I saw all these young men, working class backgrounds, head shaved, you know, in training to go to Vietnam. And that's a vision that stuck with me, and I can still see the trucks moving past me as I walked free, a visitor, where all these young men were going off to Vietnam. And that stuck with me over 50 years later, that sight. You know, and that's something that's remained, and I can still see it in. As I close my eyes, I can still see the trucks going past, and it occurred to me over the years continually what actually happened to them and what actually they went through. So I recommend the Trial of Chicago 7. It's on Netflix, and I recommend it to people. It's a terrific movie. It's a piece of drama. Fabulous performances. And it's a great piece of work, but read about it more behind it, because it's even worse than you thought it was.
Mm. Right, it's duly written down, and that will be seen.
Yeah, and I don't want to actually. I haven't watched the frame of the Olympics, so yeah, yes.
I was wondering about that. I thought you would have been absolutely good. Although I noticed something again, Channel 4 pointing out that there's actually relatively little of it, really.
Yeah.
You know, unless you're sort of paid up to watch. But I mean, I've tried to dip in and out, and it just, I don't know what it is. It just doesn't sort of it's not gripping me at all. And it's nothing to do with, well, is it to do with the Team GB? It might be a bit, but it's not that. It's not that. No. It's because, I mean, most Olympics you can get completely involved in.
Absolutely.
In a completely other performers or performers, athletes, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a strange one.
Yeah, so nothing on the Olympics. I did enjoy the golf, though, with Colin Morikawa winning the Open. A marvellous performance by the young man. But, yeah, the Olympics have just passed me by. And I'm a man who can remember Mighty Mouse, the Minnie Mouse, Don Thompson, winning a walking medal in Rome in 1960. And I've been, you know, and Mexico and Munich and all, Montreal. Absolutely adored the Olympics. But for me, the change, I think, probably came in London 2012, where I was far more interested in the Commie Games in Glasgow, far more interested. But that's it. So I will not be switching on. And after this, I'll be going out and doing some gardening again, looking at my tomato plants. And I've got chilies growing as well. So that's my exciting day.
All that. That's a great choice.
I know. You too. Yeah, I know. Didn't he let on? That's my modernist credentials and street cred are out the window. Growing my own tomatoes and
growing
my own chilies.
Well, we'll have to compare tomatoes then, because I came back from Egg to see this whole garden kind of completely overgrown. But, you know, desperately waiting for some rainfall. It's terrible because everybody else is not wanting rain.
Yeah, exactly.
I had rain for 2 months. You know, I don't know if people, you know, when you go to the other side, it's pretty blooming. People on Egg, which is, you know, a part of the whole of the west coast of Scotland has been designated a rainforest, right?
Yes.
So, you know, it gets rain, right? But actually, a lot of the water systems are almost dry. People are talking about how to cooperate on switching the water that's coming out of the hills between houses, you know, if it comes to it from day to day. So, you know, that's how dry Scotland is. And this is, just feeds back into the epicness of what we're going to be talking about in the run-up to COP26, but not
well. That's us back after a fortnight, folks. I hope you enjoyed it, because I certainly did. I got to speak to somebody other than my own family, which is always a delight. On that certainly sad note, we'll see you next week, Chums.